Nick Balkin is the Chief Investment Officer of Foord Asset Management, a company that I've watched. I suppose it's a little embarrassing. I've been seeing it over the last almost four decades, the way that it's developed into, well, a cornerstone of many portfolios here in South Africa. Nick, Foord has been around for a long time. I remember the days when it was Foord and Mankies, Dave Foord and Liston Mankies. And of course, it's developed a long way since then, almost in a way like Alan Gray. Everybody knows about Alan Gray, but Foord seems to have kept a little under the radar, although your performances have been, well, outstanding.
Yeah, I mean, it's never been a focus of ours to kind of shout from the mountaintops about what's going on. I think at the end of the day, the people that come and the investors that come, we want to serve them and look after them and make sure their returns are the best we can. And I think we usually use these sorts of communications to educate people rather than anything else. I think that to us is the most important thing, is just making sure that the returns are there.
And Dave Foord, is he still involved?
Yeah, absolutely. I think he's just an amazing man. I mean, I've been around in Foord for, and we call it Foord, Alec, just as a matter of interest. No, you know, because it says Foord and Mankies, because Mankies, I guess, sounded Afrikaans, it kind of just felt right, but it's actually pronounced Foord. I've been around 19 years. So I've worked with Dave for close on half the business. I think just to be around the man is exceptional, and I've learned so much from him. And the one thing about Dave is he has a habit of allowing people to be themselves. And I think that's one of the key things that you get from Foord. When you think that Dave's this over-domineering person that kind of dominates the whole organization, and then, no one else gets to speak. But I think the one thing he's cultivated is a very flat structure, a place where facts and communication is key. And I think that's one of the things that, although he's very plugged in and still committed to the organization, he's created a hell of a organization that can outlast him. And I think that's very important.
Now, that's always a great feather in any founder's cap, that it does last, even though it's unrecognizable from the early days. How big are you guys now? How much do you manage?
Yeah, it's not something we like broadcast. I'd say we really are in the comfortable spot, of being big enough to pay really good people and small enough to be very nimble. It really isn't a size thing for us. We've never fixated on the number, and I don't think anyone should fixate on that number. The fact is that we really are flexible and big enough, but not too big.
All right, so let's put it differently. How many people work at Foord now?
Yeah, I think that's an important part, Alec. I think we sat around many years ago, and our whole point when we did a strategy session was to stay boutique in mindset no matter what the assets under management went. So we're less than 50 people across the whole organization. That takes into account Singapore and South Africa. It all revolves about, for me, the most important thing is you just can't have hangers-on and people that aren't contributing. So each person here has a particular role, but they do a hell of a lot more than their title suggests. And I think that's how you get the best out of people, by making sure you're a small team. Each person is just highly motivated, highly skilled, and works really hard. And I think what we've tried to do is just make sure that when you have heads of HRs and 50 people basically coming that make tea and don't do a whole lot, it actually breeds complacency. So for us, the way we think about it is stay small, stay boutique in mindset, flat structure, and make sure that every person carries their weight. And then you can do it with 50 people.
And it's also interesting the way that you handle investments. Many people or many money managers say they value investors, or they growth investors, or they top-down investors and bottom-up investors. Now, Foord is always had a reputation of really getting value for money. You're not going to be buying NVIDIA at $200. But on the other hand, there's a lot more to it. From the conversations that I've had with both Dave and people within the firm, you aren't you haven't painted yourself into a corner as far as that's concerned.
Yeah, I think it's an important point. I think consultants want you to define yourself, and therefore it's easy to say value or growth or whatever, because it becomes easy, you know, just to communicate with people like you and just the market. But at the end of the day, there are many ways to make money. And as soon as you box yourself into one of those, you end up effectively closing the door to the other side of it. So I think Dave's used the word imperial pragmatists. To be honest, I think it's just really, you know, just really look after the investment. Make sure that what you're looking at, you've thought about, you've analyzed, you actually are long-term in your thinking. You understand where the management are going, and you have a forecast and a forward-looking version of where the earnings are going to go, and then pay the right price. Now, sometimes if there is a 15 to 20 PE stock, it better grow with certainty for very long to unwind that. But sometimes you've got a lower PE, and then the valuation is your opportunity. I think to close the door to any one of those opportunities is wrong. At the end of the day, we're trying to price a free cash flow for our investor. And sometimes it's a cheap free cash flow that grows slowly, and sometimes it's a higher rated free cash flow that grows faster. I think at the end of the day, you're trying to understand the sustainability of those cash flows. And I think that's where the balance, because you're trying to balance the price you pay with the value you're getting. And sometimes it's just too high for the value you're getting. And, you know, that's that kind of happy tension that I think we as investors are trying to get at, and not just box yourself into one or the other.
Just explain that, cash flows.
Yeah, so at the end of the day, whether you're investing in a bond, and remember, we've got lots of multi-asset funds also where you effectively playing off an equity versus a bond and cash and property. Each one of those, if you have an example of a property giving you a 10% yield, you know, that is a effectively their free cash flow of the property company. In an industrial company, sometimes you have a cash flow that you generate from the operations, but then you have to spend on capital equipment. You spend on expansionary capital equipment. Is it going to be paying off or not? And then at the end of, you know, after the cash that comes in, the cash that goes out, that is effectively a cash yield that you can earn on the investment. And then you can try and understand what kind of required return you want for given that risk that I spoke about earlier. There's some companies that just really are well-run, well-managed, et cetera, that you'd accept a slightly lower return from because you just think it's a better quality company, and then other ones you require a higher return. And then the last point on that is it does depend where you are in the investment cycle, because one thing we are, Alec, you mentioned at the front, is we top down and bottom up. And I do think when you look out in the future and you think about where the world is going, you need to have a view on interest rates, because interest rates set the benchmark. If you could earn 4% in a US government treasury, that is important to know versus whether it's 2%, because then that free cash flow yield that I spoke about at the beginning is you compare the one to the other. So I think it is quite a complex situation when you talk about it. But actually, if you distill it into the simple parts, it's actually quite simple. Just making sure that you buy a good company that's continuing to increase its moat, meaning its competitive advantages. Get that company to be quite cash generative and return generative, meaning, you know, high returns on capital, and that's quite a complex statement, but just earns good returns on its assets, and make sure that you hold it for a long time. Generally, that works pretty well.
So it's highly complex getting to the solutions, but you've got the smorgasbord of opportunities that you're looking at continuously. And some of them are getting more appealing and some of them less appealing. How often do you change the food that's on the smorgasbord, say?
I think we tend to have one of the lower turnovers in the industry, meaning turnover usually measured is what percentage of your portfolio changes on a yearly basis. That kind of number fluctuates, but it's roughly around 20 to 25% for a forward equity fund, which means we hold on average, just the math, simple maths is on average five-year holding period for the overall equity fund. So you get a sense that there's quite a long duration to the holding period. But within that, like with most things, is there's a bit of detail that needs to be explained. say 80%, and these are very simple numbers, not correct, but gives you a good impression. 80% would be quite long-term in its nature, the companies we hold, but also there'd be the 20% that we'd look at for opportunities, you know, and that would be to play a cycle to, you know, there's a discrete opportunity that we think there could be a takeout target or, you know, something like that. So I do think that the big portion of our portfolio are these good quality companies, all the things that I spoke about, but then there's also room to take advantage of tactical opportunities.
I remember in the BizNews portfolio, when COVID hit, we saw Sasol at 20 Rand a share, for instance. And even for us, that was an obvious opportunity. I guess you can maybe give us some of your war stories there of opportunities that you've found, perhaps more recently.
Yeah, I think it's important that you bring up Sasol. It's a hard one because our job, when I talk about opportunities, and this is important, is that opportunity doesn't mean that something's beaten down and is going to bounce because it's near zero and near its deathbed and then suddenly isn't near its deathbed and is worth more. For me, a tactical opportunity would be, and we've spoken about it at a recent client presentation, but Premier. You know, Brait was a forced seller effectively of Premier, and they were unloading stock in the 60s because they had a bond that they needed to refinance. Being able to be the liquidity when that happened, to me, is a much better way of going about it because it's a high-quality business. The management are great, but there was a liquidity event. To me, I'm not into, you know, Sasol goes to 20 Rand and it's a near-death experience and let's try and guess whether it survives or doesn't. You know, that to me, that's less exciting to me than finding great opportunities like that. Like a Wilson Bailey, like a year ago for us, is it a construction company, the best company in the world? Probably in the kind of rankings, probably not. There is construction risk and, you know, just general risks that do come about. But at the price we were being offered a year and a half ago, we had a feeling that gross fixed capital formation was going to grow faster. And the order book was going to go up a lot and the margin had a lot of room to run. So we'd rather buy that and sit there and hold Wilson Bailey in a double, which is a really good company in the construction sector, well managed in that segment of the market, and a lot of runway to play. So those are the sorts of opportunities I talk about rather than, you know, the share price has fallen and mean reversion is not something that we buy into, that some things that's fallen naturally has to go up again. This is not like gravity and, you know, other sciences where that sort of thing always has to happen, you know.
So just as well, from our perspective, we didn't know all of that because it was a near-death experience. As it happens, Sasol did turn around, but it might not have. Where you're talking about is, I presume, in the aftermath of not being able to sell its Australian asset, which was half the business. And then, well, because of the government intervention with Wilson Bailey, and then the share price fell as a consequence of that. So then it was presumably oversold by people who looked at it in a more superficial.
Yes. So importantly, they had already tourniqueted the Australian business and had already sold it after we looked at it. We wouldn't have looked if that liability sat there exactly. And they were sitting on a net cash position at that moment once the Australian business was sorted. So this was a business that had sorted itself out. It was, importantly, all the other construction businesses besides Raubex had effectively exited South Africa. So you have, I use my words carefully because the Competition Commission looked at it a while back, but almost oligopoly type with Raubex and Wilson Bailey, that, you know, there's just the capacity was taken out. So when you bid and you're only two people bidding for a contract, it is at a better margin than if there were 10 different bidders because the balance sheets aren't there for the other guys to put up the capital, because when you bid on a contract, you actually need a substantial balance sheet. So those are key areas that we focused on. But primarily, there was a underspend on fixed capital formation, and we saw it coming back in South Africa.
What about the long-term holdings? For instance, Naspers, where if one had bought into Naspers in the late 90s when they bought into Tencent and ridden that wave all the way through to today, or I suppose even better, just a little while ago, you would have made a spectacular return. Do you work on finding those opportunities as well?
Yeah, I think, I mean, that's the holy grail of investments, to ride an investment for 20 years. You know, I mean, we weren't smart enough. We were kicking ourselves because we actually never bought Naspers in the kind of really, you know, strong years in the very beginning. But the worst thing to do is to stay wrong. We realized our mistake. And, you know, to be honest, it actually became a higher quality business as Tencent entrenched itself more. I mean, I remember going to China near the beginning of the run, actually. And some of those guys really didn't think Tencent was going to survive at the real beginning, you know. And so actually, avoiding that first few years, while it solidifies and maybe does a lot of, you know, share performance, it's okay. We tend to sit after that first run of a new company or, you know, something as it's developing. But once it becomes ingrained and becomes the number one super app in China, to be honest, you'd rather pay just because it's done well and performed well. Actually, the moat has increased and the power of the company is better. Even though you might come in later, you've got a better risk-adjusted way of investing because it's an already entrenched winner.
What about today when you look at China, which as we are speaking has had a fantastic run in the last 2 weeks? Shares have come off the bottom. They're up 20%. You look in the United States where there's all kinds of flags being waved on stocks like NVIDIA and some of the other big AI winners. How are you at Ford seeing this whole picture?
Yeah, I think it is a really hard one. I think the way China works and the way we think about China is long-term, it's still a very important market. We think that everyone talks about the aging demographic and you know, as being a big issue for the Chinese. What they don't realize is the GDP per capita will grow so fast that it will offset some of that aging population. So remember, they are coming from a much lower base than some of these other developed markets. So, you know, people are getting smarter, they're getting, you know, more educated, and they're going to earn a hell of a lot more. And they don't have to be as smart as the typical American yet because the base is low. So thematically, China is a very interesting country to us. Undoubtedly, they got problems that they need to solve, right? They're trying to solve the property problem, which is they did overextend property too far, and they've now tried to put a pin in the property market. And we know that it doesn't happen quickly. So our investments in China are not built on the fact that there's a quick turnaround in China. But the reason we did own some shares in China and do have a weighting in China is because we were buying Alibaba on a 2-3 times price to free cash flow. That's that metric that I spoke about. You can invert that, which means it's over 50% free cash flow yield before the run. So I look at different investment people and commentary, and I think David Tepper said it really well, with David Tepper's really famous US investor with a really good market touch. He said it a few days ago, just go out and buy China. And they said, what's your hedge? He said, well, valuation's my hedge. So sometimes there is a point where at a 33% pre-cash flow yield, you don't need the PE or other things to work for you because you're already sitting on something that is generating enough free cash flow in the investment. Having said that, you do need to size your weight in your portfolio, given that it is a country that does come with risk and you don't want to overload it. But there is absolutely opportunity there. In the US, we also don't have zero in the US, but thematically, when we look out, we do think that we use a simple gauge. I mean, there's probably, I'm just looking at the time, we're probably not going to have time to cover all of it. But we do use something called MICE, which is money for the market, interest rates, confidence, and earnings. It's a real temperature gauge for any of the countries and see where that's going. For the US, the earnings are really, really high. The price you're paying on the S&P is over the long-term average. It's over 22 times price to earnings of the overall market. You can talk about NVIDIA on its own, but the overall markets are. And the debt in the US economy is a problem. And, you know, when you run a 7% deficit, which is you're spending 7% more than you take in taxes, Well, it's actually even more than that, because 7% of GDP is an overspend. Most of that going out to just bondholders to pay interest. It is a real problem that long term we see real issues for the US. So when I spoke about a lot of it, there's always this thematic underplay, whether it's country thematics, actual, you know, themes that we like to play on global terms, but there's always some sort of underlying long-term thought of where the world is going when we plan it out. And then, but we need to make sure that the underlying company pays a good free cash flow or has a good return. So that's that balance that I spoke about, that we try and merge both of them. And you should be forward-looking in your thinking, because it doesn't help, as I said, just to be a normalized earnings guy that says, well, the past happened and this is going to happen. You have to think, well, what are interest rates going to be in this country? How will they play out when it comes to the debt in the US? And I think those are important thematic things that get taken into account when we look at an investment.
Very rational perspective on the way that one should be investing. Nick Belkin is the Chief Investment Officer of Ford Asset Management. I won't make that mistake again, Nick. And I'm Alec Hogg from BizNews.com.
Thanks, Alec.